right, time for undergradphysics.com, debatephysics.com also, but the debate is thin. Okay, the adversaries don't have much of an argument. So, there's not much to argue, frankly. I mean, in any kind of debate format. And they also play the trick, you know, you talk about it, and you answer all their questions, and then they finally just get around to starting all over again. Yeah, which is really irritating. Anyway, so a couple of comments and see where they go. I think one of the subjects probably will deserve richer explanation. So, and it brings about a thought relevant to kinetic energy. So we'll get there eventually. A bit about NASA and some photons. That was the title of the video, and this comment is not really about NASA and photons. But anyway, incorporating the reflective index of the sun into models of gravitational lensing effects improves agreement with measurements of the phenomenon. So we know that the measurements of the phenomenon are almost non-existent. The Eddington experiment was really only the only successful with visible light. The rest of the experiments are with radio waves, completely different in some respects, in the sense that you're not creating images, and you're not paying much attention to the amount of light you're seeing, and all of that. So anyway, so this is at some, whatever this, EOS.org research spotlights a better understanding of how the sun bends light, okay, and it's just crap. All right, it's no point even going to the article. It starts with the same old jive that somehow Eddington proved and all this crap, and you know, it doesn't acknowledge any of the truth. And then it sort of makes the argument that somehow the sun has a reflective index, when of course it doesn't. Okay, it's not a transparent medium, so you're really talking about the sun's corona, and of course that's already argued, is that the sun's corona is filthy, and the point is you're going outside of that filthy area. Now, the fact is, okay, is that even outside of the filthy area, it's still dirty, okay? The sun projects atomic bits a long way, okay, from the sun, and it controls them. So just like Saturn's rings, you could argue that, well, what if there were little particles so small they didn't reflect any light? Well, then you wouldn't see the ring, would you? But it could still be there. So obviously, this is like an ionosphere. You could use words like that. But the only way a force can bend light is it has to be manipulating matter, moving matter, and the matter is going to bend the light. So the light has to hit an electron or a proton to be in any way affected. You can't affect light unless it hits one of those things, the bits that make up the light. So let's understand, the light isn't a blob, isn't a particle. A photon is a group of particles and an arrangement. And you can disrupt the arrangement, okay, by putting matter in the way. Little tiny bits of matter. Because photons are rather large. Their polarization is thousands of atoms. So they're obviously, a photon is a big object, relatively speaking. Relative to an electron, it's a big object. It's made of bits smaller than an electron. But it, okay, the thing you call shark is made out of cells that are, you know, smaller than the shark. You know, I don't know. You know, we're all made out of bits. Well, a photon is made out of bits. So anyway, so yeah, this is all mush. The truth is that there, you might get some lensing because there might be places outside of the sun, you know, distant, very distant from the sun, where there is a place where there's a ring, okay, where there's a sphere of particles, you know, bits of atomic crap that are stuck in a magnetic association with the sun and, you know, ions, and they're stuck, okay, and they just drift in that sphere. And if you shine photons through that sphere, you might expect to get some deflection. Now, I would argue that at these distances and at this density, it's probably not going to be enough for you to see any kind of deflection, but who knows? But that would be possible. The idea that the sun itself has a reflective index is just such baby talk that there's no point in even indulging in it. It's such mush. It's so far from an accurate analogy or a way of describing how light gets bent. All right. That should be enough for that. All right, so yeah, we're back to ING. Okay. Compressing a spring twice the amount propels a mass four times as high. So this is into gravity. Yeah, and so does the lever. So does anything. Twice the velocity will get you four times the height. And why is that? Is the point I've made repeatedly to you and pointed out the obvious. So I'll point out the obvious in some more classical mechanics 101, okay, way. Because you're the one rejecting classical mechanics 101. You're rejecting the whole superposition arguments about gravity and the forces and how they interact. It's clear that physics says, okay, that if I have something moving and then I apply another force this way, that the two forces are independent. This force is independent of this force. This force going this way won't change how far this goes, and vice versa. Okay, this force won't change how much it bends if the force is equal. Now, what's obviously being spoken here is that if I go through this force fast, I'll get less of it, obviously. If the force is this distance, that's where it's raining, I run through it really fast, I get less wet. I walk through it really, really slowly, I get soaked. The argument is that simple. It's physics 101, all right? And you're rejecting it, overtly rejecting it, saying, I don't understand, I can't get it. It matters how fast you go through gravity. Yes, it matters how fast you go through gravity. You get affected less if you go through it really fast. Just a fact. All right? And you keep rejecting that simple fact that explains it all, that makes it all, the whole theory, every little puzzle piece fits with that model. It's consistent with every other experiment. So I'll just describe some experiments you could do that illustrate the point obviously and that you're rejecting. All right, so we know when we propel an object. So it's unfortunate that, you know, I went looking for lever animations, and so I do have the one lever animation that's pretty good, but it's so wrong, right? I mean, they don't have the lighter object twice as far out, and they don't have the lighter object go four times higher, you know, when of course that's what it does. All right, but anyway, what do I want to do? I want to get rid of this. That's what I want to do. Okay. All right. So it's the classic, you know, baseball example of, you know, you throw the baseball and it, you can't change this. Okay. The gravity is going to push down on the baseball. All right. At a certain rate, and the baseball is going to land in a certain amount of time. And so it doesn't matter how hard you throw it. You just drop it here. Or you could throw it over here, and it's going to land in the same time. Okay, it's not going to. It's not going. You can't change the force of gravity, the action this way. You can't change it. All right, this distance won't change it, because this distance is obviously you're moving through this gravity quicker. You have a much, much higher velocity. So even though it looks like a longer time, it's not a longer time. It's going to be the same time because it's going to hit the ground in the same time. So obviously, the little arrows hitting you here, okay, are hitting you for a longer time, okay, than the arrows here, like as you go out. But it's exactly the same number of little arrows are going to hit the baseball because it's in the gravity exactly the same amount of time. All right, it's getting rained. It's hitting rain the same amount. This is moving really slowly, getting hit by the rain, getting hit by the rain, getting hit by the rain, getting hit by the rain. Okay, slowly, distance-wise. This is moving much faster, barely getting hit by the rain, barely getting hit, barely getting hit, barely getting hit. So this is getting 10% per foot, whatever you want to say. And this is getting, 90% per foot, or whatever. You know, the numbers of the amount of distance for how much rain is going to hit them, okay, is, and it's exactly proportional. So the faster I go, okay, it's not going to change the scenario any until I go, you know, obviously gravitational, orbit, all that kind of crap. I'll never hit the ground. So that's physics 101. So I'm not rejecting physics 101. All right. I mean, it's clearly obvious what the explanation is. So you could do this with like a river, okay? And you're gonna float your boat across the river. All right. The river has a direction. You know, it's going that way. All right. Now, the obvious truth is that how much are you going to get bent into the stream, right, is completely dependent on how fast you can go across the river, how fast you can get through the molecules of the river hitting you. The faster you do that, the less you get bent. The slower you do that, the more the current's just going to take over, and that's going to become your new destiny. Now, that's a fact. That's physics 101. All right, and you're saying, I'm not going to pay any attention to anything you say. Okay, you know, I'm just going to pretend this is four times the distance or whatever, and therefore it must be four times the work or four times this or four. No, it's not four times. So gravity, obviously, I already did this, you know, what Galileo demonstrated, that it's 1, 3, 5, 7. Okay, all the odd numbers. So if I shoot something up in gravity with twice the velocity, as he's stating, so I use a spring, I compress the spring twice as much, I've doubled the velocity, I've doubled the weight pressure pushing back. You compress a spring, you compress it with weight, okay, and it releases with weight pressure. The pressure of pushing it this much and then pressing this much is exactly twice. So if I go twice as much distance in compression, I get twice the weight. All right, that's a proven physics 101 fact. All right, so you have no expectation that it has four times the energy. Twice the weight is not four times the weight. Twice the weight is twice the weight. All right, and the simple truth is that Galileo is physics 101. Okay, the fact is this is going to take over. Okay, this 1-3 ratio is going to happen. You're going to go in the first half of your voyage. Let's just cut your voyage in half. Let's just say your voyage is some amount. All right, and this ratio is the consistent ratio. And so in the first half of your voyage, you're going to do the 3 thing. In the first second, you could say. All right. And in the second, you're just going to do this one thing. But what's the average for the seconds? Well, obviously, the average is just 2. Okay? So it's actually just the other 1, okay, just doubled because of your speed. And that's the simple truth of it. This is all you've done is you're in the gravity twice as long. So all you've done is you're go four times higher because you're going much faster through the gravity in one portion, and then you're going the slow amount in the last portion. So this much faster portion, okay, just makes it so you get hit by a lot less gravity, a lot less resistance to your motion, because there's not enough time. It's a timed event. It's how long are you in the rain. Now, how many times do I have to say that, right? You're saying that's not a valid analogy to say that gravity is just rain, all right? Even though it has every feature of being just like all the other forces, something that just rains on something, a pressure. You want to believe it's a bent geodesic or some other thing. Well, that's your prerogative. But don't tell me that I'm violating some physics 101 by arguing it's clearly just a timed event. It's clearly just time dependent. All you've done is double the amount of time you're in the gravity, because you have twice the velocity. It didn't take four times the energy to go four times higher. And if I want to go 7 times, I can go 7 times. You know, I can keep increasing how many times higher I go by increasing the velocity, because I will travel more distance per second. Unfortunate. Lost the tip to the pen again. I'll be back. Yeah, I took the opportunity to clean up so I can do it again. Start over. No, I'm not going to do that. But So this relates to the lever argument, relates to all these arguments where you're saying that because it's more distance, therefore it must be more work. And the point being made is that if you have a higher velocity and you're going through a stream, you're not going to be bent as much. So if being bent is an example of work, not as much work will be applied to you. It won't be as much work. It's less work to travel through gravity if you go faster. The faster you go, the less the gravity can affect you, because it needs time to affect you. All right. The simplest illustration is the rain example and throwing something like a baseball. How wet does the baseball get? Okay, and clearly I can throw the baseball faster and faster. It gets to the location at the same time. Therefore, there's no other choice but to realize that, well, if it's going to hit the earth at the same time, no matter how hard I throw it, then it's going to be in the gravity the same amount of time. It's going to be just as wet. The one that goes further is not going to be wetter. All right, physics 101. All right, and so we have the lever argument that just kind of, look, it settles the issue if you recognize what it's actually doing. So it doesn't move, the exaggerated amount, okay? So it just moves, in the example I showed with the lever, it was a 1-to-4 ratio, okay? So it's 4 times the distance out on the lever. And it only moved 4 times higher. It didn't do the 8 times higher thing. All right, I should stay with your example. Sorry, it's almost the end of this pen, so we want to give it its fair chance to finish its productive life. So if I did the half math, if I went twice the distance on the lever, well, that's not very much. We're very well illustrated here, but whatever. So I'm twice the distance out. I go twice as high, not 4 times as high, while it's attached to the lever. But if, as soon as I allow it to freely fly through gravity, that is, not be augmenting the G-force, okay? When it's connected to the lever, it's transferring the pressure between the two objects. It's doing the conversion, the actual energy conversion. So that's why it only moves twice, because it's only twice the total energy. But if I let it fly, then all of a sudden it's 4 times. So if I let them fly, I end up with the 4-to-1 ratio. Okay, but as long as they're connected to the lever, it's 2-to-1. All right, so this should be a clue to you that the real truth is this 2-to-1 relationship. This is exactly the way to look at it. And obviously, if this is half the mass, that's a 2-to-1 relationship in the opposite way. And 2-to-1 and 1-to-2, okay, that equals 3, okay? They're equal. And, that's the simple physics 101 way to understand, is that once you're flying freely through gravity, then your velocity matters. While you're attached to an object, okay, then obviously your velocity is a component of your velocity is dependent on what you're moving over here, how much weight you're pushing. That's why it doesn't move at free fall rates. This doesn't swing down at the free fall weight, okay? The oscillation is at a different rate than the rate would be at free fall. They're obviously, because they are moving at different speeds. You can't fall at different speeds. You can't have a different speed of movement and say that it's this, because gravity pushes on all things the same, right? So all things would have to oscillate at the same speed. Well, obviously this side's oscillating much slower than this one's oscillating, the oscillating speed. The amount of time is the same, but I'm just saying the velocity of the oscillation is different because it's doing the conversion. All right. I don't know if there's much. I've already pointed out the most obvious, right? The planet, gravity, I shoot by. How much I get bent depends exactly on how fast I go. The faster I go, the less I get bent. clearly indicating gravity's time-dependent force. It's a clear indication. There's no other good explanation for why it makes a difference how fast I'm going. The only way it could make a difference is it changes how much force affects me. If I go faster through it, I get less wet. Fact. All right. I mean, if there's a hole in the roof and it's, you know, water's dripping down, you can't understand that the faster you go through that, past that hole, the less likely you are to get hit by raindrops? You don't think that's physics 101? I think it is. So what did I want to make? Oh, yeah, so I just wanted to do the simple point that, you know, what we need is the simple experiment. Just a simple, clean experiment and just end the whole bullshit conversation, right? As you just do the 10-ton train thing and the 5-ton train thing. So put your 5-ton train out here. Boy, that's barely in the screen, isn't it? All right, we'll do it over here. Oh, what? Okay, so I have a lever. I have two distances here. I put a 5-ton train here. Okay, and a 10-ton train in here. All right, and the idea, you know, so it's just, I'm just doing the, you know, inverse mass to velocity ratio thing. So this could be 5 ounces. It could be 5 pounds. It doesn't matter. Here's your fulcrum to make it your bearing. All right. And the simple truth is that you will find that the 10-ton train going 5 miles an hour, 5 velocity, 10 velocity, okay, that these two things will create each other. That I can put 10 tons going 5 miles an hour and hit here on the lever, and I will create 5 tons going 10 miles an hour here on the lever. They can't possibly have differential energies because one creates the other. This one can't have less half the energy because it couldn't create twice the energy. And obviously, there's nothing here to destroy the energy, nothing obvious. I mean, the bearing's going to absorb some. So there's no reason to believe the 5-ton train hits here and only half the energy moves on the other side. Because obviously, again, if I turn this into gravity, if I just turn this experiment into gravity, it will oscillate. I've proven that, okay? I have put the 10-ton train, and I actually put a 2.5 train on the other side further out, but anyway, I've done it. I showed you in the video. It oscillates just fine. The 10-ton train going 5 miles an hour and the 5-ton train going 10 miles an hour, if I just invert it into gravity and I let that oscillate, it oscillates perfectly. The 5-ton train on one side oscillating at 10 miles an hour, the 10-ton train on the other side at 5 miles an hour. It oscillates perfectly. And you're still arguing? You're still pretending there's some viability to this notion that one side of that lever has twice as much energy on it? I mean, and then you insult me by saying, I don't know basic physics. I don't know the basic rules of basic physics. Well, I do know Newton's third law. You're the one saying you're rejecting Newton's third law. You're saying the bullet has 2,000 watts, joules of energy, and the gun only has 2. You're saying that. Momentum, Newton, Galileo, and Descartes all say same difference. Tiny little 1,000 times less atoms going this way, going 1,000 times faster, is the same thing as 1,000 times more. It's the same money. Money is momentum. Momentum is a currency equation. And that's exactly what energy is. It's currency. You can have the currency in 5, 10s, 20s, 100s, 50s, all that stuff. You can have all kinds of denominations of currency. But 50 singles is the same as a $50 bill. It's the same amount of money. I've got to find my piece again. All right, so Levis finished reading the comment, I guess. So it's compressing a spring twice the amount propels a mass 4 times as high. Twice the velocity, okay? So you didn't say that. Compressing a spring twice the amount causes the object to leave with twice the velocity. Okay, that's also a fact. Just twice the velocity, not 4 times the velocity. All right, it propels a mass 4 times as high. Exactly, and because it will travel the distance faster. Duh. Okay. It has four times the potential energy. So again, he's saying if I lift something four times higher, I've given it four times the potential energy, when again, the same argument can be made when you're falling in gravity. You fall this much the first time. Oh, you're only going 4.8 meters per second. Really? That's your real average. After 1 second, you're really only traveled 4.8. And then in your second, you're going to travel three times that amount of distance and three times that average speed. And that's all you've changed. And if you put those two numbers together, what you did here and what you did here, and you take an average of that, you'll only end up with two. Twice as much. All right. Directly related to 1/2 mv². So again, of course, yes, this is the origin of the stupid equation, is gravity. This misperception of how gravity functions, that every foot is always the same foot. Doesn't matter how fast you travel through it, you will get hit with the same rain. That's what they are arguing, okay? And gravity, of course, doesn't work that way. Just like rain doesn't work that way. The faster I travel through the force, the less the force can affect me. Fact. So if I take a 1/2 second to travel the same distance that you traveled in a second, you will get hit by twice as much force than I will. That is the truth of gravity. They didn't know that 350 years ago. Well, some people didn't know it. Again, Leibniz's argument failed. And it was only when a woman put it into a trivial kid's book that somehow this bullshit, okay, became a viable theory. I mean, Jesus. And we're not even sure she believed it to the end. Okay, but you're too logical. Okay, so he says, directly related to 1/2 mv², classical mechanics 101. So it's not classical mechanics. The first thing they teach in classical mechanics 101 is momentum. So you're not telling the truth. Okay. But you're too logical for that, it seems. Yes, I'm too logical to accept a notion that creates all kinds of nonsensical perceptions of reality. That 8-pound balls going twice as fast knock down more pins. You know, if I half the mass of the ball. That small wrecking balls would knock down more buildings. That, go on, that there's 2,000 joules going out of one end of a gun and only 2 joules going the other way. That you can violate Newton's third law, and that you can create free energy machines so easily as merely putting energy into a lever on one side and just keep putting lighter and lighter masses further and further out on the lever and create your free bullet energy. Yeah, I don't believe in free energy. I believe that if you have a theory that says it exists, that necessitates its existence, that theory is probably wrong, because obviously we would have it by now. If it was that simple, if 5-ton trains going 10 miles an hour had twice the energy as 10-ton trains going 5 miles an hour, then we would have free energy, because it's too easy to knock something twice the mass into a lever and collect twice as much energy on the other side. That's just too easy to do. And we can't do it because your theory is wrong. And you won't accept any responsibility for the fact that you cannot respond to these arguments with anything but to just restate the same claims, to sit there and in some way attempt to mock my intelligence by telling me there's some obvious fact that dictates that it's just about distance. How far did you travel through the gravity decides how much gravity you've overcome, when clearly all the facts of trajectories and how they're bent in space, all the facts that Newton used to get correct answers points to the fact that it's a time-dependent force. That it's about how long you're in the force, not how far you travel through the force. Damn. All right, so we'll move on. How does your theory describe the particles and interactions seen in particle accelerators? All right, maybe I'll erase the board and think about it. All right, particle accelerators. So there's lots of mythology. You know, they tell you stuff about how accelerators work. You can't really see any of it, so you have to trust the stories being told by the people running the accelerator. But some of it you can deduce, okay, from other experiments and other mechanisms, and so you can make draw some conclusions that they're not telling you the whole story. So the whole story, I mean, it starts sort of with Einstein and the photoelectric effect, okay? And there's two elements to it, right? You hit a metal with light, and you can cause a current. You know, you can make electricity. Or the idea is you can eject electrons with a certain amount of energy, okay? Now, if you're ejecting electrons, you can sort of understand that you must be making the surface positive, right? Because you've knocked electrons off, so it's got to be becoming positive in some way, right? I mean, there's no way the matter can lose electrons and not become positively charged relative to what it was. So light can affect the charge on a surface. So in accelerators, all right, so let's just talk about now, like even x-ray tubes and different things. They use what's called an electron gun. And the electron gun, okay, isn't exactly what they're describing. So even in whatever it's called, well, I'm not going to remember, but maybe I'll remember later. I can point it out then. But anyway, you put electricity across a coil. Now you pump in a high enough voltage, and what happens is you start creating all kinds of radiation, you know, ultraviolet radiation, different kinds of radiation starts flying off the coil. And what you're really doing, you know, I mean, you can logically sort of understand it, is that you're also shooting atoms off the coil. It will degrade. It'll start falling apart because you're putting a lot of energy through it, causing it a lot of disruption. So to create the light, you're vibrating the atoms. And if you vibrate them enough, you start to break the atoms, okay? And so now the pieces are flying off. So when they make what they call an electron gun, it's not just electrons. There's all kinds of ions. You know, all kinds of nuclei are also in the stream that's being shot. Now, the trick is that you could sort of understand that as you're shooting all of this crap, Dunning-Kruger? No. Yeah, that's the stupid thing they always say. What that? Yeah, the silver atom experiment, you know, where they have the silver atoms and it creates the two teardrop kind of whatever you want to call it, pattern. Stern-Gerlach, okay. And Stern-Gerlach is using the same mechanism, basically, and it just, instead of, it depends on what material you use. So if they used silver, and they heat up silver, well, what do you think's happening? Yes, the silver atoms are flying through the space, okay, the ions. You're breaking up, so you have electrons flying, some of those maybe independent, and you have the nuclei, okay, that are positively charged. Okay, so anyway, so an accelerator, you have to understand that's what you're shooting, okay? And to shoot it, what's going also with it is a bunch of x-rays and, you know, different kinds of high energy, okay, particles, light, sorry. So it's like a fluorescent bulb, right? A fluorescent bulb has a cathode and an anode. And the idea is you're just shooting stuff through the space between the two. Well, yeah, but it's bouncing off all the walls. And the fluorescence is the tube, is the fluorescent part. Okay, what's traveling from the two sides is just ultraviolet radiation, mostly. And some x-rays, I'm sure. So you're just basically shooting light through gas. Okay, and you know, you have to have some conductor in there. The gas, okay, you're hitting it with the high-energy light. It's deflecting into the fluorescence, okay? It's making the fluorescence light up with regular white light. Okay, so that's the That's, you know, it's not what they describe. It's not as simple as this is an electron gun. So this is the same mechanism used in all these experiments, accelerators, all kinds of things. They're using the same mechanism to create what they say are electrons, but they're not just electrons. All right, so anyway, back to the story. So in a linear accelerator, they just start with an electron gun. Okay, they start with a fluorescent tube, essentially. They're just saying, basically, I have a cathode and an anode, okay? I have a charge differential, a substantial one, okay? A million volts. All right, between these two objects, all right? I'm basically going to rip, one object to pieces. It's going to degrade. It's going to be losing its bits to this charge differential because I'm going to start pulling pieces off of it. That's how they start motivating these particles. But they start with this, without this heating element, okay? Without the, without this creating the particles for you to accelerate the charges, there's nothing to accelerate, right? So understand, they create the particles with the heat, then they create a field, okay, of positive and negative. Obviously, the electrons are going to want to go this way, and the ions are going to go this way. So you're now separating the ion particles from the electron particles, okay? But you're still shooting, the thing you're using to shoot with is still the ultraviolet and other high-energy photons you're emitting from the emitter. They're what's pushing those electrons, all right? And so you just go through stages where they just keep doing this amplification, and then they, when they measure the energy, okay, it goes almost at the speed of light for even very low energy. I don't know why all these emails, but anyway. So even at very low energy levels, like 1 million volts versus, say, 5 million volts, there's a tiny difference in the speed. Okay, so the speed double goes up. It goes from, like, 89% of the speed of light, to 92% of the speed of light. So there's not a proportional difference in the arrival time. And so that's got to tell you something that, well, if it's arriving at almost the speed of light, then maybe what you're measuring is the radiation, the X-rays and the ultraviolet. Now, they have a giant brick wall at the target. So the target is through a hole in a giant brick wall because, 2 foot thick, because they're afraid of the radiation, right? They're not afraid of getting hit by an electron. They're afraid of getting hit by all the X-rays, okay, and gamma radiation that's coming off of, that's being shot through the accelerator, all right? So, you can sort of surmise that what are they actually hitting this target with? Are they knocking electrons off? Well, it goes negative, so you can't say they're knocking electrons off. These are going to measure how much negative stuff gets to it. Because the electrons are negative, so you can sort of say, okay, the electrons must be hitting the surface. That must be all that there is to be causing the effect. But the effect also could be caused because you actually shot more nuclei off the target. You shot more positive charges off than you shot negative charges off. So the high energy radiation, I could simply argue, is more likely, okay, to knock a proton off of the surface than it is to knock an electron off the surface. And that's why it would go negative. But the key point is what I really want to say, the flaw in all of it is the fact that once they get to certain energy levels, all of a sudden they stop measuring how much charge it gets. Because the charge potential, I can't surmise why that would be. It's certainly not going as high as the 5 million volts. So why don't they just keep measuring charge? Well, that's because there's no change in the charge. So they pump in more and more energy, and yet they don't get any change in the amount of charge on their plate. But their plate gets hotter. Okay, so I think we all know that photons can certainly cause heat. So isn't that kind of bogus to sit there and say, well, there are more and more energy because the plate got hotter? Well, how do you know those are electrons then? Because photons will make it hotter. More photons, more heat. So, there's a lot to accelerators. I can't do it all in one video or, but I'm just saying you have to take what they say and what the real truth is aren't always the same thing. I'm just saying you have to be really, really careful when you start listening to them talk about we're shooting electrons, because maybe that's not what they're doing. And maybe you can understand that can't be what they're doing. There's no special mechanism that shoots electrons. It shoots all kinds of stuff. And so it should be understood that the other stuff in this beam could be the key thing, the thing that's really doing the action, and that the electrons are incidental. But anyway, I'm just giving you some reason to doubt that everything they tell you is exactly how the machine works, that they're simplistic. Well, this thing just shoots electrons, and then we accelerate the electrons by putting them through a charged field, and blah, 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 blah. When obviously all along this path, there's little giveaways that it's doing something more, because all of a sudden they're wearing radioactive suits, you know, lead suits. All of a sudden they're protecting themselves from all the other crap that's coming off of this device. So it can't clearly be as simple as a bunch of electrons are just streaming through there. There has to be something more going on, or you wouldn't be wearing that lead suit. All right. I think that covers it. Covers it as far as I can take it at this point, okay? Because there is a lot of, you know, they're apparently, the first acceleration is through a charge differential. The later accelerations are through using somehow radio waves in some way. I don't know exactly what they're doing to create, you know, a pushing mechanism to accelerate. But the point is it's not very effective. It's not taking something that's going 20 miles an hour and making it go 80 miles an hour. It's taking something going 20 miles an hour and making it go 22 miles an hour. It's kind of a weird concept, this acceleration, because it's so minor relative to the, you know, it's a minor increase in speed by absolute percentage. Tiny increases. All right. So you have to sort of argue that the foundational speed is the one that's really critical. And are you measuring light traveling through the accelerator, light in the form of ultraviolet and X-ray, or are you measuring actual physical material particles moving through the accelerator? It's, in my opinion, an open enough question. So I think that's enough of that. All right, a couple of kind of junk comments in the positive way, but worth reading anyway. So, after regular study and months of following tens of videos, Veritasium and others, only now I can say I understand electricity a bit. Thank you very much. Thank you much. Do you have or subscribed in any forums? Yes, I've been kicked out of every forum because you're not allowed to challenge any elemental portion of physics in any forum. It's like some blanket rule that you're just not allowed to argue foundations. Okay, they say these are all truths and you must believe them. You must believe our axioms, and all you can do is debate tiny mathematical changes or something. You're not allowed to debate anything meaningful. Or you will be shut up. You'll be exterminated. Okay. But I do have a website, and there is stuff on the website. So, you know, frankly, I'll show the website soon. Just because I showed it poorly yesterday. So I'll show it better today. Anyway, so this other Brandon guy says, you remind me of this guy in some far-out wacky way. So it's some philosopher who had some pretty good quotes about the point is that the only thing you can really control is you. And you can't control you because you is already being controlled by you. Gets quite circular. You're controlled by ideas. And if you have an idea that you're being controlled by ideas, then that will give you the idea that you have to look for ideas to be controlled by. And your brain can do that. It can logically evaluate the different beliefs that you can accept or reject that will, you know, enable your brain to construct strategies and all of that stuff. So, again, the only thing you can control, that is your brain can decide because it has the belief and the knowledge, is that, wait a minute, I can't control how they act. I can control how I react. So I can understand there's a strategy involved in every interaction. And if my goal is a certain goal, I have to understand that I have to obey certain strategies to get there. That if I make the situation worse, then, you know, I'm going to have to deal with a worse situation. So I have to understand that there's rules to the game. Now, I would argue there's some immediate circumstances where you're almost just like, say, fuck the rules. Okay, somebody's actively beating somebody up. Well, you hit them with a sledgehammer, you don't worry about, well, was that excessive force? Or some kind of bullshit. Shouldn't I talk to him first? There's circumstances where you really don't have time to think, or there's no way you can stop your visceral emotional reaction. So sometimes you just have to say, fuck you. You really should have said, gee, I don't think we are intellectually in the same position at the same time in this conversation, and it may not be to either of our advantage to continue communicating in any way, as we are seem to just be accelerating the heat index of, molecular permutations. Some sort of bullshit. But I'm just saying that's the way you have to live your life, is recognizing that with every interaction, you're deciding outcomes, and you only have so many neurons to use to process all those interactions. You have to try to figure out strategically which ones are more important, which ones are less important, and all that crap. And it really is a pain in the ass. And most of us can't do it all the time because it's just too much work to constantly reevaluate and consider every single reaction you have, or every personality defect, or every instinct, or whatever you want to call those things. Every bit of your personality can't be controlled by you, controlled by any logic you can apply. You can't even make sentences anymore if you're spending too much time thinking about, well, I want to say this. Should I say that? Well, can I say that? I mean, it automatically has to happen, or you're not going to happen. You're not going to talk if you just don't let yourself talk. And how you'll talk will change over time, depending on how many of these little lessons you learn and how much practice you take in terms of trying to say it the right way instead of the expedient way or any of that other crap. It's philosophy. Yes, that's a good thing that people do that and they think about it. But yes, in that sense, the quotes in the video you point to are very similar to ideology I always advocate for, except I would probably be a little more aggressive and say sometimes you need to hit first. That's the only road to victory, is hit them hard and hit them first. You'll lose otherwise. In terms of you even get the hint that they're a spy, even getting, sometimes you have to react to just the smell of it before it actually, the duty actually starts flying out of the ass. So if you don't react to the smell of it and push the butt away from you, you're going to get a load of shit. All right. Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like that. All right. So sometimes you just can't, patience and discipline and care will not be rewarded. It's just a fact. So that's another, it just makes it more complicated. Yes, thinking is always a good thing, but sometimes, okay, it won't help. It's just a fact. You got to just act, and act fast. All right. So I think that's enough. Yeah, I think that covers everything that needs to be covered. I wanted to say about the other comment, just this electricity bit, it's also for me. That's why I like this comment. It was only just because I have the same reaction. It's almost I want to thank myself for providing me a rational explanation for something that has been mysterious all my life, magnetism and electricity. Where does the magnet get the energy from? This was something that bugged me and bugged me and bugged me and bugged me. So for most of my life, I sat there saying, how the fuck does this little tiny magnet where does it get the energy from? It doesn't get any lighter. There's no perpetual energy. So where's it coming from? How does it make this stuff happen? And, the realization that it's not making anything happening. It's not making anything. It's just changing something that already exists. It's just changing it. It's changing how it looks, And that simple fact that it's just reflecting it at a different, the simple analogy that it's just reflecting it at a different color. It's just reflecting it differently. So it's the same energy that's hitting everything, and it's just reflecting it differently. That made so much sense. That's where the energy comes from. The energy comes from the outside, and all the magnet does is change how the energy looks, and looks matter in physics. That is, whether you're pushing electrons or pushing protons will matter. All right, anyway. I suppose it's a little too complicated to say it that simply, but I mean, yes, I mean, it's just nice to have answers that seem reasonable and physically tangible, that they're answers that don't depend on something unimaginable. It's imaginable now, and I like that. All right, so till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. So this has been at draftphysics.com. Debate physics also, but just so few debaters around who wish to debate what's actually spoken. the actual arguments. So anyway, till the next time and such.